Hello.
Okay. All right.
There's plenty of room. We can move empty chairs if people want more space around them. We'll talk about that.
Maybe at a break time?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Great. So let's begin with a bow, please. Then our opening chant. Please sit tall. Check in. What's your starting point today? Invite your whole self to be present. Nothing in us needs to be locked away in a closet, relegated to the shadows, disavowed, blacklisted. You remember for just one moment that love is what you were born with. All parts of you deserve that love. Will, in due time, relish that love. So feel your feet. Feel from the knees down into the lower legs. Directly the sensations. The tightness, the overnight accumulation. How quick we are to close back up, right? Exhale to relax, just the lower legs and the feet. Very subtly, the feet sort of spread out upon the earth, upon the ground, as they soften and open. Pelvis, your thighs. Feeling and surrendering. Definition of surrender is to join the winning team. We surrender our tension. That is exactly what we're doing. The belly gives up its struggle. Organs can relax. The low back can relax. Breathing in to feel the upper torso, the heart, the lungs, the ribs, so much life. This body is a cosmos, infinite points of sensation, pulsing, ringing out, saying, I am here. Arms, elbows, hands, fingers. connecting, relaxing, connecting and relaxing over and over. The head says an experiment, see if you can take your attention right to where the end of the spine is and the beginning of the cranium is, right? The very top of the spine. And the skull rests there, right at that little egg-shaped bone called the occiput. See if you can feel right into that tiny area. And then the brow unfurrows, the temples relax, the ear and the inner ear relax. All around and behind the eyes, relax. Cheeks, lips, teeth, gums, roof of the mouth, back of the mouth, the tongue. Jaw and the chin. Relax. Come back down and land in the space of the heart. Center of the chest. And then trace back into the body, between the sternum and the spine. The heart space. You can literally feel how things just sort of open up as you move towards the back third of the body, closer to the spine. There's more space. So it's as if your nose is right there in the space of the heart. And you're breathing into the heart and out from the heart. allowing the breath's natural rhythm to emerge. Recalling that this is an actively receptive state. We don't become present so much as we open to receive the presence that's already there. We put down the other things. Just open. And then we'll do two breath works together. So we're going to start with the 12-fold belly breathing. So please begin taking full inhales down to the belly, letting it expand. And first, just bringing the navel back towards the spine. Exhale, exhale, exhale. Relaxed but full in-breath. And this time, navel back and perineum lifts to meet it. Breathing in through the nose and out, either through the nose or through the mouth. Staying mindful. That's two more. Okay, we'll do one more round. Please begin. Wisdom energy in, awakened energy in. Just clarifying the confusion, the cobwebs. Knocking the rust off the pipes, if you will. Just a couple more. Enjoy the blessings. And then we'll follow that with the ninefold clearing, alternate nostril. So please bring your left index finger up to the left nostril, breathing in through both nostrils. Closing off, breathing out through the right. Little push. Good. Breathing in through both. Stale energy out. Breathing in. And appreciate, as you take this natural breath, the openness of the right side of the body. And then right index finger to right nostril. Same thing. And then the openness of the left side. And breathing in through both nostrils, light energy coming in through the crown of the head and down the spine on the way in. Confusion and exhaustion up and out on the way out. To conclude our practice today, I will read from Rob Bresny's Pronoia. If you want to follow along, it's the last page of your handout, or if you want to just relax and stay as you are and take this in meditatively, that's also an option. Thousands of things go right for you every day, beginning the moment you wake up. Through some magic you don't fully understand, you're still breathing and your heart is beating, even though you've been unconscious for many hours. The air is a mix of gases that's just right for your body's needs, as it was before you fell asleep. You can see. Light of many colors floods into your eyes, registered by nerves that took God or evolution or some process millions of years to perfect. The interesting gift of these vivid hues is furthermore made possible by an unimaginably immense globe of fire, the sun, which continually detonates nuclear explosions in order to convert its own body into light and heat and energy for your personal use. Your hands work wonderfully well. Your heart circulates blood all the way out to replenish the energy of the muscles and nerves in your fingers and palms and wrists. And after your blood has delivered its blessings, it finds its way back to your heart to be refreshed. This wondrous mystery recurs over and over again without stopping every minute of your life. You can smell intoxicating aromas. You can hear provocative and soothing sounds. You can taste a thousand different tastes. How is any of this possible? You can think thoughts anytime that you want. Big, wide, colorful thoughts or tiny, dark, burrowing thoughts. You can revel and wallow in great oceans of emotion. What colossal secret intelligence or improbable series of fabulous accidents conspired to bestow these superpowers upon you? Language is another stupendous marvel. Millions of souls have cooperated intricately for untold centuries to cultivate a system of communication that you understand very well. Your ability to speak and read and write makes you feel strong and dynamic. It connects you with the world. It allows you to indulge in one of your greatest pleasures, which is to hear and tell stories. Maybe this is the best gift of all. You have a staggeringly potent creative tool, your imagination. You use it to create mental pictures of things that don't exist and that you want to bring into being. Your imagination is the engine of your destiny, the catalyst with which you design your future. Or maybe this is the best gift of all. You know that you are you. You are exultantly and extravagantly aware that you are alive and conscious and awake and unique. You have a million different feelings and fantasies about what it means to be you. Do you remember when you were born? It was a difficult miracle that involved many people who worked very hard on your behalf. No less amazing is the fact that you have continued to grow ever since then, with new cells being born within you all the time to replace the old cells that are dying. At this very moment, there are 50 trillion cells in your body, and each of them is a sentient being in its own right. They all act together as a community, blessing you with their astonishing collaboration. It's just like magic. If you can't smile and bow to that, then I don't know. So good morning. I feel like this is the real good morning. Like, you know, practice is just like that. Sometimes it's like, oh, that's who I am. Where are we? So I want to rewind the tape a little bit. And, you know, part of healing is understanding, you know. Some would disagree with me, but bell hooks agrees with me in that theory can actually be quite healing, especially if you're the type of person that when you take in potent ideas about why things are the way that they are, you immediately start applying it to your own life. Oh yeah, okay, that, you know, helps me connect that experience to this thing that's going on, you know, like that. So connecting the dots. So I want to talk about how it is that we got here from being born full of love to living lives that are filled with confusion at times. And love certainly persists and prevails, but we become disconnected and we become unclear about the way things are and about the way things work so often. Did you have a question right up front?
I have a question. I was looking for the right time to ask it, but it relates well to this moment.
Okay.
You keep saying we're born full of love.
Good morning, part three.
Yeah. Thank you. So you keep, it seems like a premise is of this whole three-day retreat is that we're born full of love. And I am wondering if that's something we're just supposed to accept, or I am someone who theory helps me understand. And so when you said you're born full of love, I was thinking of two recent definitions of love I've heard. Like, bell hooks is one that I particularly like. Her definition of love is about that it's an active thing that you do. It's an act for others often, or for yourself. But then the work of evolutionary biologist Helen Fisher talks about certain forms of love, particularly romantic love, as actually operating like a craving in the brain and a want. And so then, I'm interested in hearing your take on this idea that we're born in love.
Sure. So you're interested in the technicalities. I'm coming from the poetics. Mm-hmm. Side of the spectrum. Does that make sense?
It does.
Love is a shorthand, and what is it, like Eskimos have like 50 some odd words for snow, and you know, there's like 13 different words for love or something like that, estimate in Sanskrit, and then we have just one just one in the English language, right? So I'm using love as an umbrella term. An umbrella term for, you know, and it's not just me saying this, it's the entire Buddhist canon is based on it. And in, you know, many strains of the Vedic system of belief and practice would also, you know, agree. And the internal family systems, one of the reasons why I resonate and just dove right into that whole mode of thinking as well, would actually offer the, in an accessible way, the most technical description. And so I'm going to go with that one. In IFS, it would be called self-energy. And self-energy correlates to Buddha nature or natural mind or in Zen, big mind or the Atman or self with a capital S in Vedic culture. And I really enjoy Dick Schwartz's delineation that self-energy has there's four main qualities that all begin with a C, and then later he delineated eight. But the main four are calm, curiosity, compassion, and creativity. Babies, when they sleep, they sleep. Right? Endlessly curious. Endlessly, you know, when I was a kid, I can't live this one down. I used to have a thing for records. Like when I was like, you know, the moment I could walk, I was getting into like records and record players. And I was 3 years old. I don't remember this, but it's a famous story in my family. And we were over at some family friend's house for dinner. And they let me wander off, and they took their eyes off me for a little bit, and they came too, and I was dismantling the record player in Luann and Herb Farrar's living room. So I was endlessly curious, what is this, you know? And children are just like that. And then, I'm sorry?
Can you repeat the
sentence? Calm, curious, compassionate, and creative. You know, and kids are naturally inclined towards compassion as well. They tend to, you know, if they see somebody suffering, they feel that, they take that in, you know. And then creativity, you know, for me, creativity is just anything that is life-affirming. You know, anything that is in touch with the life instinct as opposed to the death instinct. Right, anything that contributes to the hum of life that pulses within us. So we could look at, you know, our true nature, our deeper nature from many different angles and come up with many different qualities to it. In the Buddhist canon, they would say vast, open, and actually no qualities of the natural state are stagnant or fixed. It's all just pure potential, right? But pure potential in the direction of life, that creative force, right? And my teacher says it's a space that gives birth to love. It's a space that's open and without qualities and yet somehow warm. So, and because of that, we can also see that basic nature in the truth that it's the nature of the human organism to heal and to move towards healing and restoration and growth. Unless we're in the presence of stressors, right? In the presence of threat, because the first prerogative imperative is survival, right? Then we our organism switches it up because we want to live. But when not in the presence of stressors and in the presence of the right conditions, it is absolutely the nature of our being to disentangle from confusion and hurt and to move in the direction of restoration. The opposite of the stress response, fight flight, is rest and digest. Right? When we are in the presence of the right conditions, generally speaking, relaxation and warmth, being received, feeling a sense of belonging, these kinds of conditions, our system automatically, you know, the our vital fluids all rush back into the torso, go into organ repair mode, repair nerves, etc. And that's physically true, and it is my strong belief that it is psychologically true as well. And that when confusion arises, and even when painful things arise in the mind, and even the painful and repetitive patterns in our lives are evidence of that. The painful and repetitive patterns in our lives are actually like an alarm bell going off, saying, "Do you get it now? You got something to look at. I need you to heal." So How do we get there, though? Okay. So, if we think about sea turtles for a moment, the way sea turtles are born is mom rolls up on the beach, she buries her eggs, she pieces out. Eggs hatch sometime later. Already embedded in their DNA is their ability to go off into the ocean and fend for themselves. Born like that. We are radically different. 18 years? 14 to 18 years? What? That is a super long time to be hitched up to caregivers for everything, literally everything. The parents in this room are going, yeah, everything. I worked my ass off, right? They didn't do a thing. There's a terrible comedian, Chris Diella, who's like, babies come out, they can't even make a sandwich for themselves. Talk to me when you can feed yourself, kid. Right? Everything. Food, clothing, shelter, warmth, love. Everything. And that's a big deal. That's a big weight. That's a big responsibility, considering, you know, the contrast to other mammals in the world and how short of a time that dependency is. And we're also, from 0 to 5, we're in pure intake mode. We're recording everything. It's posited that that's one of the reasons why the remembering mind isn't online yet, is because we're just pure input. Right? So we're taking everything in. And then we're born into a situation in which people are confused and there are traumas already existing in the environment for us to take in that come out in myriad ways, right? And then it's not just that we're taking it in, we're taking it in through child eyes. Remember being a kid? Remember being so convinced that your fantasies were sometimes real? You know, I had all kinds of crazy ideas about how things worked when I was a kid. I remember carrying this secret anxiety and terror when I was around 4 or 5 years old, because somehow, and I don't know where this came from, but I had gotten it into my head that the way it worked was little boys grew up to marry their sisters. And I had 2 sisters. Which meant that one day I was going to have to choose, and one of them was going to be hurt. And I was deeply, like, troubled by this. And then one day I figured out, and I never spoke about it either because I was so freaked out. And then one day I figured out, oh, no, that's not how it works. Okay. But we take in the confusion that of the world through eyes that are that fantastical, through a perceiving mind that is that innocent, right? And then the trouble begins, right? And it doesn't even have to be trouble, really, by the way, because of that whole premise of we take it in through child eyes. You know, when I was when I was born, it was the 70s, and there was 2 things going on in child rearing that were trends at the time. One was because starting in the 1950s, we started thinking that we could manufacture nutrition better than Mother Nature could, you know? And so it was mothers were encouraged to feed their kids formula and not to breastfeed. Right? Whoa. Because we know now that that is 180 degrees in the wrong direction, that breastfeeding is one of the most important experiences for a child to have. It teaches, it imparts upon them so much about bonding. You know, their system is flooded with oxytocin in those moments, and it's such a precious experience for kids to have. There was another, perhaps even more toxic, popular child rearing trend at the time too, which was that if you picked up the kid while they're crying in the crib, you were teaching them to be dependent and weak. And we're Americans. We are rough and rugged and self-reliant. And, you know, you would teach the kid to have a tough skin, a thick skin, if you just let them freak out on their own. And what happens when a baby cries and nobody comes in to soothe that child is their nervous system just ramps up and ramps up and ramps up and ramps up until at some point they're going to give up. You know, and then that experience is embedded. And through no fault of any parent who ever, you know, took this on, they were just buying into what was the popular health trends at the time. You know, not a iota of aggressive intent in these harmful practices. But the kids took it in. And I have a theory, actually, that since these practices started sometime around the 1950s, right? And then around the 1970s is when you start seeing really angry rock and roll and then giving rise to punk rock and then giving rise to, like, death metal and grindcore and, like, these really, you know, unprecedented, aggressive forms, very angry forms of music. I don't know. There's a little bit of a correlation there. Wow. You know? Mom rage. So, there's some things that make these experiences quite powerful. In psychoanalysis, these would be called model scenes, and we've all had our fair share of model scenes, both the kind that we can't remember and then the kind that we do remember. Every name that you got called in grade school, right? Or any sort of meaningful experience you had that just really stands out in mind. Something symbolic, that something really impacted you. When I was a kid, my dad walked out on my family when I was 4. My mom started having to travel for work around the same time. And, you know, when she would come home, I would sit there waiting at the window, waiting for the headlights of her car, which I had memorized, right, to come around the bend. And I would just sit there waiting and longing. I was like 5, 6 years old. And that, for me, is a model scene. You know, it's played out in my relationships, this like core sense of longing and waiting and when are you going to show up for me? A model scene is a scene from your life that your psyche becomes organized around. And the bad news is, because of the survival imperative, our minds, our brains, are hardwired to devote far more resources to negative experiences than they are positive experiences. We talked about this on day one. So, and all of those resources that are being devoted to that negative experience represent energies that are being burned in through the power of neuroplasticity. They're leaving imprints. And then, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, the window of consolidation, how your caregivers react to you when you're in a moment of distress, when you're expressing vulnerability, when you're expressing hurt, or sometimes even when you're expressing your liveliness. Right? How many of us as kids just had an excess of energy and then we were told that that was wrong, that we needed to be some other way? Right? But especially from painful experiences, how your caregivers react. And so often, I mean, how many of you had, you know, maybe were bullied or beaten up or had some sort of negative experience growing up, and then when you came home and told mom or dad about it, you were told it was your fault? You know, maybe if you didn't do that, that wouldn't have happened to you, or whatever it was. But how many of us experience painful things and then experience a second layer of a not so skillful response to us talking about that? Yes, please.
Oh, Given what you've been talking about so far, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are. I've heard from experts that narcissism is becoming more prevalent in our society, and I know personally I've had some experiences with people that I would strongly believe to be in that category, which were painful for me to interact with them. So sure. I'm just wondering if you have any insight from your studies as to, you know, why that might be the case. Do you agree with that? And how do you deal with narcissism?
Yeah. So
thank you.
So let's hold that question for right now. I mean, yeah, I wanna come to it a little bit later, if that's all right. And remind me if I somehow forget. It's Sunday for me too. So this window of consolidation business for the clinicians in the room, you know, this is why it's so important to, how a therapist or a healer reacts the very first time they tell you a client will tell you about a trauma. Because you're reopening that window. And there's an opportunity, especially if you have a solid relationship with a client as a therapist, and they might be projecting some mom and dad energies onto you, right? Looking at you as a caregiver in their lives, you know, they're reopening up that window of consolidation. So how folks react to your painful experiences really, really matter. And then, and this is where the narcissist piece starts to actually trickle in, is it's not just what happens, it's what does it say about me? Right? This is where we start forming beliefs. What does it say about me that this happened? What does it communicate to me that that happened? Generally speaking, our painful experiences communicate to us some sort of message about our worthiness or worthlessness. Everyone I love leaves. I only get love after waiting at the window for this long. I'm not good enough. You know, that you treated me that way means that I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy of respect. Right? I'm not worthy of kindness. I'm not worthy of warmth. I'm stupid. Things of this nature. Right. And then, as if this wasn't enough, we tend to believe that whatever is going on in the present moment is permanent, don't we? Remember the last time your heart was broken? It felt like that was just how things were from now on, right? Like, I'm never going to get past this. Remember the last time something was so exquisitely wonderful in your life? Maybe it was just a moment or like a really good concert or a really good meal or you just had a patch where, you know, things seemed to really fall in place and you're like, whoa, I'm on a roll here. Right? And then the grave disappointment when the show ended or when things started falling apart again in your life or whatever. We somehow believe that things are permanent. If I had woken up this morning and this iPad hadn't turned right on, if it had died, I would be pissed. But the fact of the matter is, there will come a day, sure enough, that I will go to turn this thing on and no juice. Right? It's guaranteed. And yet, when that day comes, I also guarantee that I will be surprised. And what the fuck? So we believe things are permanent. We believe that how it is now is how it's going to be forever. So these are deep, deep imprints that we're taking in. And then there's a way in which we these messages become reinforced through self-fulfilling prophecies. I'm unlovable. I take that into a relationship, right? you must be crazy for loving me. In fact, I don't believe that you actually love me. How many of us have done this? I don't believe that you actually love me, and so let me create some drama. Let me make some waves in the relationship and just see if you can actually handle how crazy I am. Right? Or I'm unworthy, so, and I only feel okay when I have my own space. Right? So don't come too close. That's going to freak me out, too. You know? How successful is that strategy in a relationship, you know, when wielded unskillfully? So, you know, folks who are on the clingy side of the attachment spectrum tend to hold on, tend to check, and tend to try to make sure the person actually cares for them through creating drama or just clinging or controlling behaviors, right? And then what's going to happen in that situation? I got to pull back from you. This is too much. I'm unlovable, I'm unworthy, just got reinforced, right? Person who is less comfortable with intimacy, has their needs shut down, is more on the dismissive side, you know, is going to go down a similar trajectory that is going to cause a partner to feel, I can't get what I need from you. You're too withdrawn, right? I'm unlovable, nobody cares for me, reinforce. Am I connecting the dots enough here? All right, I'm being very general because this isn't rocket science and this isn't new information. So, there was a hand up, actually. Yes, please.
I wanted to know, my husband doesn't remember his childhood, mm-hmm. and I know so much comes from our childhood. How do you work with someone when their childhood is like a big black hole?
Yeah, yeah. You work with what is present. You work with what you know. So a colleague of mine that I worked at the clinic with had a teenager who was assaulted, and she didn't remember the assault. Because the stress system takes our memory system offline. And if any of you have a childhood where things are spotty and you don't remember so much, it's quite common, it's generally the result of inconsistent parenting. You never knew what you were going to get from mom and dad. You never knew what coming home was going to look like. Or you never knew if I did this thing one day, you know, I'd get this result, but I could do the same thing another day and get a different result. That sort of parenting puts a kid in constant stress mode because their system unconsciously feels like it can never just relax. It doesn't know what's going to happen. Things are unpredictable and things could turn. Take a dark turn at any point. And so there's an aspect of that kid that never drops its vigil, right? So stress response kind of corrodes our ability to remember, our capacity for memory. And in the supervision session, with that colleague who had the girl who couldn't remember the assault, the master trainer we were working with at the time said, just work with what she remembers. Because the traumatic stress is there, and it's showing up in her behaviors, it's showing up in her emotional responses to things, and so you can just work with it there.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm one of the kids who wasn't bottle fed and was left alone to cry in the crib. I don't remember that. I just know that from my mom telling me that that's what she practiced, and you know, the mom rage that's there. It's present in my relationships. It's present in my life now, and so my therapist and I work with it on just the level of the present time experience. Am I engaging in enough self disclosure today? My God. But anyways, back to me. Right? So, this comes from Yangi Mingye Rinpoche, who is one of perhaps the most adorable man alive. So cute.
How do you spell
Yongyi, Yongyi, Mingyur, Mingyur. Rinpoche, Rinpoche. Yeah. He's, arguably the happiest dude on the planet. And he was among the first cohort to be put in fMRI machines by Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. And he talks about the three kinds of relationships we can have to any sort of experience. Right? One is the feeling is your boss, right? So let's say I have an I'm unworthy, I'm ungood enough, and that's my boss. What does that look like? You're right, I am not good enough. Oh, you're right, I am unworthy. It sucks to be me. Depression, suicidality, right? Angst, hopelessness. Let's say you have an unworthy or a not good enough, and it's your enemy. What does that look like? I got to make sure that possibility is completely shut down, and any sense of unworthiness is not exposed to anybody at all. And if I'm in danger of that being exposed, then I've got to rally against it and throw everything I've got at it not being exposed. Overachieving. Type A, right? If I've got to win at every argument, that's a hot one right now, right? Given the political climate of the country, like how many of us are engaging in these arguments online? Like comment threads have never been nastier, and they were nasty like last year, but they are like it's horrible. How many internet debates you see going on, and no one's listening to each other. Everyone's thinking you either don't have the information or you're crazy. That's it. And let me tell you about that. And then the other person is saying, no, you don't have all the information and you're fucked up. So I'm not listening to you and let me tell you about it. Right? But it's really at the core of that is I can't be inadequate in any kind of way. That is intolerable to my system because it triggers stuff that is just sitting in our bones. We don't have the capacity as children to process what we go through, the whole of our experiences. And so our experiences and our emotions can't make that journey from birth to death. And so they go to live in our bones. And if I'm carrying an unworthy and it is my enemy, it's going to elicit all that unworthiness I haven't processed from childhood, and it'll be quite intense. And that can also look like narcissism. Don't you dare tell me I don't know what's going on. And I've got to fend for myself like crazy. This world, you know, this world is filled with confused people, and I'm the only person who has it right. That's called a personality disorder. Yes, Stuart.
So I'm curious about your suggestion of a skillful way to be with a child, a 3, 4, 5-year-old, who may not have the verbal skills to go inside. Mm-hmm. How does one be with, other than be a wide presence in and of themselves?
Right.
Could you speak to, I'm thinking I have a grandniece who mm-hmm. just acts out a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be able to be a loving presence for her and assist her in whatever way I can without intruding on her. And so how do you breathe into, acknowledge, meet that child? Could you speak to that?
Sure. So yeah, like you said, no ability to go within. know, I mean, we don't really even start developing a self, self-awareness or a reflective capacity until like 8, 9, 10, somewhere in there, you know. We barely know we're a person at her age, you know. Dr. Dan Siegel, who has given us a tremendous amount of really wonderful research-based parenting technique and theory, he says the pivotal thing is to feel felt, that you register that other people are feeling you, that they are attuned to where you are in terms of affect and able to anticipate your needs based on that awareness of where you're at. That's the most nourishing thing and one of the most important things for a child to receive is attunement, which it sounds like you have that intention to be attuned. So it's tough with kids who really act out. It's tough. I mean, I worked in clinical foster care for a year and a half, and, you know, it's really tough to see the hurt beneath the kicking in walls or throwing things. Or we had a kid who put a chair through a window in a classroom because they took his handheld game system away. Because it was the only thing that, like, he just had to be in another world because out here was all of his trauma. And when they took that away from him, you know, and he was seen as a spoiled kid who was just addicted to video games. I was like, no. That was his safe place. They took that away, and he had to fight. And fight he did. And unfortunately, the system you know, hospitalized him and things just went downhill instead of hurt people, you know? Anger is sad's bodyguard. Right? So can you look to the emotional reality beneath the behavior? So, can we wait for the mic? Actually, thank you. Sorry, I'm not used to this mic thing myself.
I'm curious if there's like how early you can introduce meditation to a kid. And, like, is there any studies around that or, you know?
Depends on the kid. Just depends on the kid. I have friends with kids who are, like, 3-4 years old, and because they're meditators, they want to do what mom and dad do, you know? And they'll hang out with them, you know? You know, but 1 minute is a lot for a kid, especially, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. But yeah, early, and tons of research out there. Quick Google search will reveal a lot. Are you an educator?
No, I work in medicine, but
okay.
But I'm new to the meditation in this kind of whole world. But the Headspace app was my introduction to it, and I have an 8-year-old nephew and an 11-year-old niece, and we did the Headspace kids like before they went to sleep, and they responded really well. And it was a really, I was like, man, this is, you guys should be doing this more. You know, this is cool.
Yeah. It's being integrated into schools more and more, which is really exciting, which is really, really exciting. And the teachers love it because then the class behaves. So it's a win-win, you know? Yeah, the Dalai Lama said if we taught all kids to meditate within like a couple of generations, we would have world peace. So that's the bad news. As we, the unconscious mind, awareness itself, has no boundaries, has no opinion, just takes things in, it lands in our bodies, you know, it revs us up. We need to have some sort of survival-based response, right? As kids, we can't process it. It says something about us. We think that it's permanent, right? And then others respond poorly to it, and it just, it's like, heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps, and we're just talking about, you know, one experience at a time, and then we grow up with that stuff just sitting in our nervous systems, right? Fighting against triggers, fighting against, you know, it coming to the surface, trying to keep it all stuffed down, trying to keep it all manageable, trying to be good enough. So we, you know, we go to a New Age circle and they tell us, you know, positive vibes only. You know, how many of us have encountered some sort of spiritual community where it was like, you know, just let that go. Let that go. That's not your true nature. The Tibetans believe that you shouldn't mourn after somebody dies. Yeah, because the Tibetans believe that you shouldn't mourn after somebody dies. Because for 49 days, the spirit is in the bardo, and they can hear you, and they can feel your thoughts, they can feel your energy, and if you're weeping and crying and sad that they're gone, in Zen they believe this too, they can feel that, and that's going to disturb them and add confusion to their journey in between worlds. And I've seen it enacted. I've seen it enacted. A good friend of mine was killed in a bike accident. She was part of this heavy-duty, very traditional Tibetan Sangha. And my friends in that Sangha did not grieve. And I was like, whoa. There's some cancer cells forming right there. Like, yeah. So, but again, it's in our nature to heal. The reason why these things bubble up to the surface and manifest in our relationships, manifest in our behaviors, and manifest repetitively, again, is to get our attention. Is to, you know, I have a teacher who says, when you find your face flat on the floor and you're saying, how do I make sure I never get back here again, you're finally asking some good questions. You know, because the first principle is healing, right? But in order to heal, we need awareness. And in order to develop awareness, the repetition must be there. So that is that this stuff is going on in our lives isn't a bad thing. It's actually evidence of our Buddha nature, of our natural propensity to heal, the love that we were born with. So, yes, please. Oh, Mike, please. Thank you.
I had a question or sort of wanted your take on like how much environment sort of like plays a role into these like behaviors, because like we actually just moved from New York, so like I sort of feel like there's a certain like toughness you have to put on when you're there. And then like, I remember when we first moved here, even when I travel and people are nice to me, I'm like, what's wrong with you? Like, why are you asking me how my day is? or even like, you know, yesterday, to give an example, we were driving and, you know, someone like flicked us off in the car and they were like so angry. And I was just kind of like, whoa, like, even, I guess, just environments, whether it's, like, cities versus country or even just, like, road rage, or, like, how much does that sort of, like, play a role?
A ton. A ton. yeah, because, again, we take it all in. That middle finger aimed in your direction, you felt that. So yeah, I mean, all of this stuff that we're taking in is taking place in the environment. And then in terms of working this stuff out, I mean, everything we're talking about, like communities that are emotionally checked out, like that really matters. For kids, if they are acting out, you know, for kids that we know have been traumatized, which is pretty much all kids, childhood is a minefield. You know, and when we're engaging them in therapy, though, one of the things that we try to do is make sure the conditions are right, you know, because we have to feel a sense of safety in order to heal. We need the right conditions in order for the stress response to die down. And so we look to the environment. We look at what's going on in schools. If they're acting out in schools, are they in the presence of triggers that remind them of their trauma? If they're acting out in the home, you know, what's going on there that's getting them so wrapped up? It's not happening just because they're a bad seed. You know, so it's stuff that we take in from the environment and the people. And of course, culture influences that, how people behave and interact. So nature, it's our nature to heal. And that's only bad news as long as we're asleep to it. Okay. So we need the repetition, we need the awareness, and then we need the skillfulness. We need to develop a process. We need to be conscious. We need to be specific. I had a client recently who said to me, we were doing parts work and we had discovered that there was this child part of her that needed reminders that life wasn't all terrible, that there was good things going on in every moment. And I said, okay, well, when you're on the train to work, you know, do you think you could, before that, you know, we came out of the parts work and she said, you know, I feel like I have these insights in therapy and then I just go out there and I forget all about it. And I said, yeah, you need to show up and do the work. It's not like you do an hour here and then the rest of life just opens up and, you know, it's all good. And so we gave her this exercise to do on the train of writing down three things that weren't terrible in her life every day. And you're showing that kid, have an awareness, have a specific, explicit awareness. I'm showing you, you know, my inner child. These three things on a daily basis to help keep that kid calm and feeling safe. But we do have to show up and do the work. I want to share with you a case study. And I've got to put a big trigger warning because there is some talk of child abuse in this case study. So you can get your defenses up if that's appropriate for you. Where is it? Okay, it is in the middle of your handout, and it's a case study of Ellen. Her name has been changed, and this is used with her permission. So this is how a model scene might manifest symbolically in somebody's life. Okay, so Ellen originally reached out to me for a meditation session. She was having anxiety, daily panic attacks, waking up almost every night, screaming with no recollection of it. She would learn about it from her husband. And constant ruminations about just the worst case scenario. Which, if you are 80 to 95% of our thoughts are all thoughts that we've thought before. That's how repetitive the mind is. And if your thoughts are negative in nature, you'll actually hit closer to the 90 to 95%. So, this is kind of a cruel truth. She is relatively privileged, lots of resources now in her adult life that she's been able to cultivate for herself. Stable marriage, nice house. She has a job working within the healthcare system, advocating for clients in court systems and in the hospital systems and fighting back against the cruelties of the healthcare system. Right. But she grew up in a foster home with two parents who had big personality disorders. And she grew up in a situation that was radically abusive, in that, you know, she's a twin, and she was the stronger of the two, and so she took the protector role. And she talks about how her and her twin would have a moment of putting their hand on the doorknob to the front door of the house, coming home from school every day, and just looking at each other, just this silent acknowledgement of, like, I don't know what's going to happen. We could walk into anything. And at best, it would be just like an uncomfortable silence with a kind of this aggressive tone to it. Her foster parents were also hoarders, so the place was just constantly a mess. And at worst, you know, they could be physically abused. So, you know, and these are folks who didn't... I once asked her if her parents ever went to any of her recitals or any of, like, the school functions that parents would ordinarily go to. It hadn't even occurred to her that they should have. Like, she's in her 50s. And it never occurred to her. And it had never occurred to her. She came to me for a meditation session. And then I said, I think we need to do this other weird thing I've got in my tool belt. You know, and we did parts work. And, you know, she had just told me this much about her history. And I was like, you know, I think that this is trauma from your childhood. And she was like, really? It was totally disconnected for her that she... she had stuffed it away so much and let it go to the extent that she was having all of these symptoms. And she was like, really, do you think it could be that? That happened so long ago. Things are so different now. Yes. Yes, that's been sitting in your bones this whole time, waiting until you had the strength and resources and safety in your life for these symptoms to manifest and for them to grow so intense that you were pummeled into calling me, right? So not a bad thing. You know, the story ends with her going to get help, which is what her unconscious mind and all of these the symptoms were pushing her to do the whole time. So if we fast forward a little bit through this, one of her model scenes is that... her adoptive father, if you go right up to the top of the second page of this, would often lunge at her. She says that they could be talking about anything, and on one day she could say, you know, something, and she would get a negative result. It's that situation. She could say the same thing on another day, and it would be met with stoic silence. But sometimes she would just say the wrong thing unknowingly, and Dad would jump out at her and reach for her neck, and sometimes abuse her, and other times, you know, it would be a little more light, or he would grab her and shake her, or he'd take her and put her in the corner, something like that. But there was this lunging with this air of, I don't know what happens next, or how bad this is going to be attached to it, that was enacted over and over again. So... very, very sad stories. So coincidentally, she has chosen a job where she is seen. She has to show up and advocate for folks in the court system. She finds herself in depositions quite often. So being seen at home was an issue. Her and her sister would often hide in the bathroom, because that was the only safe space. If they weren't seen, they couldn't be hurt. But now she has to be incredibly seen at her job. And she's, again, playing out this protector role of she's there advocating for kids, advocating for underprivileged folks in the healthcare system. She works 70 to 80 hours a week because the compulsivity around being in that protector role is so strong for her. And, I mean, there was a session when I asked her, listen, do you have to be taking all of these cases? Do you have to be taking all of these foster care cases, really, that are so triggering for you? And she said, it never occurred to me. I just thought, you know, I could lose my career at any time because I work for myself. You know, and but here she's just flooded with work, and she still has this mentality, the scarcity mentality of, like, I could lose it at any time, and would just take on more and more and more and more. I'm like, you know, you got to let some of this go. So not taking sick days. Her and her sister would go to school sick because it was better than being at home. So today she doesn't take sick days. She does take vacations, but totally unable to relax, filled with guilt and worry and checking her emails and never really taking a vacation. She just recently took her first vacation. She was like, ah, for 5 days I actually relaxed. Thank you. But the thing that we're really working with now is that she has what she calls flashes. Today she doesn't wake up screaming anymore. She doesn't have, like, full on catastrophic panic attacks. She has some anxiety. She has some ruminations. She's a depression that she had never experienced is starting to make its way to the surface, which is actually a sign of progress. Some anger is making its way to the surface, and I think that's really, really appropriate because it's been bottled for a long time, and it's right to be angry in that situation. But the lunges, okay, hold on to that for a second, because one of the things we're working with now is what she calls flashes. And flashes will come at just at random to her. And it's just a sharp spike in anxiety that seems to come out of nowhere and that can stay for 2 to 3 days of, I'm not good enough, I screwed everything up, I'm going to lose everything. You know, my husband probably is crazy and, you know, it's only a matter of time till he figures it out and he leaves me. You know, just like the whole narrative of how everything is just so terrible. And we went in and worked with this anxiety in parts work. And I asked her, when was the first time you felt this exact same way? And what immediately emerged was the lunges. And I'm like, well, you look at that. Dad's still one moment, and then you're thrown into a different reality. And isn't that just the same thing that's happening now? You're cruising along and anxiety. And it's all terrible, you know. We also discovered that these flashes through processing antecedents, what came before the symptom in her present time experience, we also discovered that they happened pretty consistently after depositions, when she would be confronted with lawyers who were really aggressive, and who, particularly male lawyers, who would use their gendered advantage, if you will, to push her around. So she's seen, she's being pushed around, she's being told that she's not good enough, walks out of the courtroom, she's fine, and basically dad lunges at her for what she's done. Right? So, but this is how it works. This is how it works. That the unconscious mind speaks in metaphors and symbols. And so the things we go through show up in symbolic ways in our lives so much of the time. Is this making sense? All the dots connecting? Questions, comments?
When someone goes through trauma like that, I've heard that a really important part of the recovery is like a grievance period. Like, mm-hmm. like you said, when we're born on this earth, we're just filled with love and hope. And it's like we're grieving that mm-hmm. this horrible, horrible thing happened mm-hmm. to us. And now we can't access that. You know, once could be like happy person, and you know, maybe we're just stuck with being miserable forever. like, why? Like, why do we need to go through, like, a grievance period? And then, like, is there, like, a right way to do it? How long do you have to do it? Or are some people just stuck with it forever?
Yeah, good question. It seems a cruel injustice. It does. But grieving is a healing, ultimately. And grief work is particularly long. And tedious. It's true. It seems to be the nature of it. I don't know why it is that way. What I do know is in order for things to heal, Marcel Proust said, suffering is healed by feeling it to the full. You know, we've got to feel it all the way through that cycle. And loss is, you know, one of the more devastating things we can face. And loss comes in all kinds of ways, right? The loss of innocence, the loss of believing that the love I wanted from my mom was even there to begin with. That's a big one, right? The loss in believing that this thing that I've spent my whole life longing for even existed in the first place. Wow. Gotta let that one go, you know? The truth is that difficulty and awakening are bound up with one another. You know, that. So my sister just died, and it was a long journey for my family who lives close to her because she had pancreatic cancer. And she should have been gone in weeks. She lasted 2 years, which is like unheard of. She was a walking miracle, and she was healthy for most of those 2 years. And then at the end, it was 24-hour care. I've never seen my family be so close. My family is actually functioning like a family these days. They talk to each other. They do feel things. There's still some attitudes around that, but they do feel things. They're closer. They check in with each other. There's, you know, we celebrate birthdays a little bit more now. You know, it's brought us together in this way where I don't feel alienated as much anymore, which says a lot. There's opportunities for growth in every bit of the difficulty that we face, so much so that in the Tibetan tradition, they actually pray for difficulties to come. There's a prayer that, you know, may I be met with difficulties, not so much that I'll be overwhelmed, but not so little that I'll just relax and space out, you know, but just enough. Jack Kornfield talks about how we are all granted our measure of sorrow. This comes from the Sufi tradition, that each of us are just cosmically born with a measure of sorrow that is ours to work with and to transform our lives from. And it's just that way, that for whatever reason.
So I'm kind of repeating in a different way my question from the first day. Mm-hmm. So like in the context of what you've just been talking about with grief taking a long time and then also just kind of these patterns that are in us. So I'm still not sure how to know when I should be holding my grief and not abandoning it, and also when it's me just repeating things. Mm-hmm. And then my larger part of the question is, I'm still not fully getting it. I'm kinesthetic, so I feel like I kind of need to understand so how is it that when there is this abuse or neglect or whatever, and then we repeat it in our lives, is it our neural wiring? Is it an energy that's bumping around in our meridians? Is it something like how they talk about how like a victim will kind of align themselves with the abuser in order to have power? I'm trying to understand or feel in my body like what's going on.
all of the above. I'm serious. It's energetic. It's in the mind. It's in the brain. It's in the sinews. It's in our cells. We know now that our emotional patterns are imprinted in our DNA. So we're not just getting it from our parents psychologically, we're getting it biologically too. You know, it's all of the above. Where we are a whole being, you know, and we are integrated. So.
And so then, like, how can I understand how to separate where I need to grieve it all out via crying, via feeling, and where I need to, and where I need to just see that I'm like, you know, harming myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And I also don't, I still don't get, like, how does it become that then this kind of energetic pattern within me or neural wiring pattern within me, like, if nothing's happening to me now, and I want to heal, and it's my natural way to heal when I'm not with stressors, then I'm just creating it from within, right? So how is that happening? I mean, I'm not sure how that's happening.
Okay. Can you ask the second part of your question in a different way?
I'm not sure which is okay. The second part.
Well, let me try to get to the first part, because there's a lot here. One is that I wish so hard that there was a universal, objective way to like measure this stuff, and that it was a universal process where it's like you do these steps and you, this is where you land. I wish. I really do. And the truth is that we all have our own journey, and we are all here to discover a unique truth, and we're all here to develop a unique wisdom, and we're not all here to arrive in the same place, or, you know, like we are, it's incredibly individual and subjective. With regards to how do I know when I am indulging versus holding, that's really what it is. There's a place we can go to where we are indulging. We're highly sensitive people. We learn that our emotions, having big emotions, are a really good way to be seen in childhood. You know, and I'm not saying necessarily that's going on with you, but for a lot of us, we learn that there's a secondary benefit, that there's a benefit to being afflicted, because in so many ways, that was the only way that we could get love or attention or to get somebody to just listen to us. If we ramped it up and we took it to, you know, that's part of my thing. It's like, just I will ramp it up and take it to a crazy place, because now are you hearing me? Now do you believe that it hurts? And those kinds of patterns are, I believe, are landing on the side of indulging versus holding. So there's a question I like to ask myself sometimes is this benefiting me in a way that I'm not admitting to myself? Is holding on to this, as is part of me so identified with this because I'm getting some sort of benefit from it that might not be at the forefront of my mind, but there's some part of me that is like, yeah, this is how I get love. This works. This is an effective strategy, man. Flipping coffee tables, effective strategy, you know? So that might be a question that's worth asking yourself, you know? Is there a part of me that's maybe hanging on because it believes that this is how I get love? Right? What I know, and this is, I'm a limited person, and you know, who's only done so much studying, but what I know from my own experience is that it is the holding. It is the moments in which the grief or the rage or whatever is present, and I'm not, you know, so there are moments when it needs to be expressed, it needs to come out, you know, when I'm above a 7 on the scale, and that's fine. But when I can, the most healing moments are when I can just hold it and just not heal it, not fix it, not anything other than just be with it in a warm, caring way. For me, that's what shifts things more than anything else, is 100% no defenses given.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing and for your vulnerability. I really do appreciate it. And I have a feeling that that question needed to be asked for other folks in the room to hear the response to as well. So you've done us all a service.
I wanted to...
Yes. Oh, the mic lady gets to answer the question?
I have a voice. I came here and basically because I'm going to be fostering a child soon, so this has all been great information for me. And you know, I was lucky. Don't anybody hate me, but I had the most wonderful mother ever. But I still have so much. I guess it's transference, or I don't know what it is, but I see a child in pain, and I think, how can I, am I going to be able to do it?
Yeah.
You know, it's just such a big job.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm happy to say Marin County has great parenting classes, and they give you a lot of information on attachment disorder and all the things that can go wrong and grieving and everything that you have to be prepared for in a negative light. Well, it's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
The child that I'm going to adopt or foster is going to be traumatized. But anyway, I don't really have a question. I just wanted to thank you and everybody here that all this information is just great. And
yeah,
it makes me hopeful.
Good. Yeah. It is a hopeful situation. And thank you for fostering a kid. That's a huge, huge deal. Get ready. Sleep while you can. Yes, please. Can we pass the mic?
So I'll just say, and as a parent of a now almost 17-year-old, when my child was first born, I asked the pediatrician, she said, the best advice is just love them. And sometimes that's the hardest thing to do because you get what you get, right? When the kid is yours or they're not yours, and there are moments when you look at that kid, especially when they get into the teen years, and you go, ew. You know, it's like, really? Is this a person? Or why are you so mean? Or why are you causing my life such difficulty? And it's in those moments you got to go really deep, and you just got to find those things, like what is the acting out about other than to make your life miserable? And sometimes it is just because they want to make your life miserable. It's true. But
it is.
But I think if you just, I mean, that's why I'm here too, is to sort of find myself, because when you have a child, you lose yourself very easily, because it always becomes their needs and their wants and their issues and their problems. And then you start to take on their behavior, you know, their behavior, you know, of acting out. All of a sudden, I said, God, I'm doing the same thing that they're doing. You know, I'm becoming this teenager too. So the emotions just run so high. It's just what it is. But I have to say that if you can tap in and just love them, go deep and love them, it's really, really worth it. There is just so much there. But it's not there all the time, and it's hard.
Yeah, yeah. Dee Winnicott, there's a story that somebody went up to him at a cocktail party and tapped him on the shoulder and said, you know, if you could whittle down the whole child development thing to just one variable, right, what would be the most important thing in child rearing? And his response was, as long as one person is crazy about that kid, they'll be fine. Just one person needs to be crazy about that kid, you know. Contrastingly, I think you're speaking to that point as well, that it's also natural to hate your kid. And I would have that conversation with parents a bunch too, you know. Like, I know you hate them sometimes. They'd be like, what are you talking about? I don't hate my kids. What kind of parent do you think I am? No. Totally natural. I can see they're driving you to your brink. And if you don't admit it, then we're going to have a problem. If you do admit it, we can work on it, you know? But same thing with intimate partners, isn't it? Susan Piver talks about, you know, the four categories of loving kindness meditation. You know, you're the benefactor, yourself, the stranger, the enemy. She talks about sometimes she practices loving kindness for her husband and puts him in every one of those four categories. Yeah. Okay. So do we need a break? Yeah. Okay. We've been going for a while. We'll take one last, and then... Yeah, Mike, please.
So my question was, in this case study, her flashes were like nonverbal. They were just like she didn't understand her flashes, and obviously you were there to help work through the flashes. And so yesterday when we did the work with the inner critic, like, it's easy to talk to something that has a voice, but I think a lot of what I work with and other people work, I think, is a flash for something that I deal with more is like intrusive memories. Mm-hmm. So they're very visual. Mm-hmm. And so I do kind of like what you're saying. I try to figure out what's the payoff for me in holding on to those memories. Mm-hmm. But sometimes even knowing doesn't make them go away. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering how you deal with intrusive, like, images or things like that, or right. Flashes, these other versions.
Yeah. I mean, even with the flashes, what we do is we go to the emotion. It's in the feeling. The feeling is the root, and it's not just the mental feeling, it's the felt sense in the body of the feeling. That's the root. And so I would steer somebody, you know, let them have the story, just like we did in the parts work. Let them have the story, but can you identify the feeling? Can you feel it in your body? And then can you engage in some sort of process? It doesn't have to be, you know, the whole blending, unblending, you know, the whole process. Just can you consider this feeling your child who's crying in the room with you? You know, this is Thich Nhat Hanh. You know, what would you do with that child? Are you going to lock them in a closet? Would you really do that? Nah. Take them into your arms, you know. Really important to explore the body, the physical dimension as well of it. Yeah. All right, break time. We'll take 10.
So we're back at 12.
dharmaseed.com?
Yeah, I know the Dharma Seed, so the whole entire week.
Usually they will all ask.
Me.
I will.
The day's over,
I will
get that information.
Yeah.
That's what they usually do.
I was like, I'm not going to take notes. I'm just going to absorb it.
Battery change went okay.
Okay. So I hear reincarnation is making a comeback. God bless the internet. Okay. Where are we? So somebody did come up to me during the break and said, I thought today was going to be easier. To which I must respond, life is what happens to plans, you know? Yeah, this afternoon will be easier. Guaranteed.
Lying down in the meadow, so that's not easy.
We will be lying down in the meadow at the end of today, exactly. All right, non-believers. What I would like to do is dive in for a round of parts work. And then we'll have lunch. This is... this is out of my intention that each of us really ingrain this process and ingrain the holding, which is the third relationship, by the way. Yang Yiming-Yur Rinpoche's three relationships... Boss, friend, or boss, enemy, and then friend, right? Or parent. It'd actually be a little bit deeper than that. Holding. Right? Enemy is repression. Boss is indulgence. Middle path, friend, parent, holding. And that's the alchemy. Sure. It's the third relationship is one of friendship, making friends with, allowing the affliction.
And the first one is boss, which is indulgence.
Boss would be, indulging. It's taking over. It's in charge. And then repressing would be, it's your enemy. It's not allowed. And we land in the middle. Always and forever. And it's in the middle that we find things. Just like it's in the middle of the breath cycle, right? That between breaths, that space between exhale and inhale, that everything quiets down so nicely. It's always in the space in between things that the answer lies. It's, I don't know why, but it seems to be a fundamental truth of just how things work. So let's settle in. I want to show you another way that this can work, and this will work for some of you This will not work for some of you. So just soften. Just melt into your chair, into your seat, into the floor, into the earth. The cheeks and the eyes and the jaw and everything relaxes. The belly relaxes. The hands get heavier. Your seat gets heavier. Once again, breathing into the space of the heart, one breath at a time, with the visceral experience of rising and falling in the region of the chest. I think the message of Rob Bresny's pro-noia reading that I read for you folks earlier is that you are loved. Each of us is loved. We are loved by the earth. We are loved by the elements. We are loved by the universe. Everything is provided for us. Everything is working in its natural order. Can you have a moment of recognizing that life loves you? There is a deep part of you that will always go towards well-being, and you can trust that. Right here, right now, feeling into the space of the heart. So sweet. As an experiment, I want you to see if that self-energy, that natural space of calm, caring, curiosity. Can it be uncovered in you? Just see. Now, a different way to get in touch with parts is to just scan the body. Look for a place where there seems to be tension. Seems to be some sort of sensation of discomfort. For me right now, even as I'm saying this, I'm starting to hone in on a sharp pang. It's very light, it's very subtle, but it's sharp and it's there, just to the left of my heart. Look to your body. Are you carrying something somatically that is starting to reveal itself? And if you're not relating to this at all, that's fine. Just go ahead and do what we did yesterday, which is think of something that's upset you, that inspired an emotion that you would like to work with here, that feels right to work with. Respect your own boundaries in choosing what scene to work with. But if you're starting to feel a strong sensation, or even a subtle sensation emerge, you to really go there and inquire of that sensation. Is there a part of me, knowing that this is a space for healing, that wants to become that wants to come forward, that wants to be seen, that wants to be held? Just see what comes. Just breathe with that sensation. The emotional quality of that sensation. And is that emotion connected to something for you? Good question to ask is, when is the very first time I can remember feeling this exact thing? And just be open to what might come. One way or the other, you should have a feeling going by now. Whether you played a scene or you just met it directly in your body. You'll be willing to feel it. Can you remember that this is a part of you? Can you remember that your true nature is that calm, clear, curious space that I know you've experienced before? If you're really resisting or hating this feeling, just ask all of those other parts of you to relax. Don't make a boss or an enemy of this. Just relax. Just simply practice holding this part of you. Maybe they don't want to be held, and that's fine. You can just be here as a person with that intention, that caring intention. If it's a defensive part of you that's screaming, you have some tools. Affirm it and debrief it. Find out what you need to do to make friends with this energy. You're dealing with some hurt. Just hold. Tell me your story. What is it that you want me to know? What is it that you need to heal, to become unburdened, to soften? And if your part tells you something that you need to do, that you can do, that you're willing to do, commit to it. Let the part know, yeah, I'm down with that. Another question that might resonate is, what would you rather be doing than holding all of this pain? Wouldn't you rather run and dance and sing and play? So please, will you let me unburden you so that we can move closer to that together? We'll begin working with the breath. Breathing in to pull away some of the burdens, some of the heaviness, some of the freak out. Breathing out golden space, warm, even joyous space if you can. Breathing in the upsets, taking them into the chamber of your heart where they're transformed into compassion, your willingness to breathe in the burdens is compassion itself. And so that is what's breathed out. It's every breath in, every breath out, the situation is getting more spacious. It's getting lighter. Little by little. Lighter and lighter, freer and freer. Then you can say any final words that feel appropriate. You can extend any final loving kindness wishes. And take 3 deep breaths to just let this go. And then on the count of 3, like we did yesterday, that big, stupid Hollywood belly laugh. 1, 2, 3. Ah! Have a fabulous lunch. We will reconvene at 2.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.